You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. This week on Mysteries and Monsters, I'm joined by Bruce Champagne, a marine biologist and former law enforcement specialist. Bruce has spent years investigating reports of hominids in locations many would be unaware of, the many deserts of America. Despite the modern perception being that the Pacific Northwest is the best place for a Bigfoot encounter, it seems many sightings in these arid areas go back to the 18th century. Bruce discusses his investigations and some other intriguing accounts, before we also dive into his other cryptozoological passion, water-based cryptids. As a marine biologist, Bruce is uniquely placed to give us the lowdown on lake and sea creatures, along with his extensive research, as well as discussing some intriguing cases. A big thank you to Bruce for his time. Don't forget, you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up for our Patreon for $4 a month for early releases, ad-free episodes, and more. Search for Mysteries and Monsters on Patreon or click on the link in the show notes as usual. Mysteries and Monsters is available across all social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and you can subscribe to our channel on YouTube. Don't forget, you can get your merchandise for Mysteries and Monsters by clicking on our website, mysteriesandmonsters.com, and using the links at the top of the page. Mugs, t-shirts, stickers, and more. Artwork for Mysteries and Monsters, as always, is by Dean Bestel. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. So it seems that there is far more to deserts than we could possibly imagine, as Bruce Champagne explains. On this week's show, I am delighted to be joined by marine biologist, security expert, and cryptozoologist Bruce Champagne, a renowned researcher, investigator, and hunter of the truth. Bruce, I am delighted to welcome you to Mysteries and Monsters. How are we?
I'm doing well. Thank you for the invitation.
As we were discussing before we dove into the interview, you're someone I've been aware of over the last few years, primarily through the work that you've had published through a couple of friends as journals, one being Carl Schuker's Journal of Cryptozoology, and obviously your contribution to David Weatherly's marvellous Woodknocks series. And what I find fascinating about your interest in regards to Bigfoot and relic hominids, Bruce, is that you seem to be really investigating a facet of the whole Bigfoot phenomenon that seems to be overlooked these days, because it's very interesting that when we talk about Bigfoot, the preconception is we're talking about forested areas, mountain lands, rainforest kind of areas. And yet, as I've noticed reading your work, you seem to have kind of harkened back to some of these pre-1950s reports where Bigfoots were seen all over the place, and especially in sort of areas we would consider deserts.
I have. It was kind of accidental. I actually live on the margin of a high desert in the American Southwest and became aware of it. I've always had a lifelong interest in the subject, but haven't always lived here. I've lived in California and other places and done field research in those areas. And then when I moved here to Utah, sightings are fairly frequent here, and a lot of them are videotaped. It has a long history of sightings here. But I became aware of one that wasn't too far from my house. And so I wanted to look into it. And it began with a woman who evidently would see a very large, dark colored biped come up and drink out of her horse trough in her backyard. Took me a while to find out about where she lived, but then I eventually found it and looked on Google Earth to see what the terrain was like. And she was even closer to the actual desert than I was. And for this animal to have approached her property would have required it to travel overland about 5 miles through sagebrush and very flat ground. I was aware of activity in the area, in a nearby desert mountain range. But I found it interesting that this animal would traverse exposed, and there's a pretty busy roadway there also.
Mm.
And when I finally found it, it all made sense. There was a very, very deep ravine leading right up to her backyard. You could drive a truck through it. That's how big it was.
Wow.
And so it kind of made sense that probably the animal was coming from that mountain range through the ravine and up to her property. And it would make calls, and it left tracks that she photographed. So then the next question was, well, if the animal's coming from there, I never quite gave a whole lot of consideration that these animals also live in the desert, or if they're not residents, are they transients? Are they migrants? Mm. What are they doing there? What are the biological advantages to living there? Yeah. And so I began the research into it a little bit further. And they have a long and rich history, these animals do, of desert habitats. Some of the earliest records and reports I can find date back as far as 1870.
Yeah.
In Southern California, there's nicknames for the animals that live there, you know, and a lot of them date back more recently, the 1950s, 1930s, 70s. And a lot of them are names that people would understand or hear if they're interested in the subject, whether we're talking about the yucca man, which is still seen with some frequency, and sun devils and howlers and Fontana speedway monsters and zubies. They have all kinds of names. And in fact, their history predates Bigfoot or Sasquatch in the popular culture by a considerable length of time. So they have a rich history that's been documented in the environment.
Yeah. I think it's very interesting for me as someone that has such a deep interest in this, and often when you discover a subject, a problem some people may have, Bruce, is that they tend to just stick with the contemporary work or continue from that point and just go forwards, whereas I've often had a deep interest in history regardless of it including strange creatures. So I've been very fortunate that I've kind of gone backwards as well as forwards to try and get as much information about this topic inside my head, because it, like I say, I just find it addictive, and there are so many avenues and stories and so many states in America with a rich history of this, as you refer to there, Bruce, that I think often we're in a danger of only looking at this sort of post-1950s rather than looking at everything that happened. And as you say, if you're fortunate enough to find some of the books that look at these stories of wild men or weird gorillas living in the deserts where they're not supposed to be, there are lots of stories towards the end of the 19th century where prospectors and people moving out into this unclaimed territory or uncharted territory stumble across weird creatures that aren't supposed to be in the Americas. So for you, when you got bitten by the bug, Bruce, were you surprised that there is such a rich history that often seems to get overlooked? Because I think that's one of the issues I've got with this subject, is that Bigfoots are everywhere, and yet a lot of people just tend to focus on where they expect them to be.
And there's been some studies on that. I mean, it provided some surprising results on the states that these animals are actually viewed in relationship to the ones that we traditionally understand.
Mm.
I did camp in the deserts when I lived in California and did research. I was aware of some of the ones that were reported to live in those areas, but no, actually, I didn't realize necessarily that the history was that deep.
Mm.
And so it was a little bit eye-opening, and it's kind of opened my imagination a little bit more into looking into other, what we would consider marginal or challenging areas that these animals might also frequent.
Yeah, I think it is surprising, because when you look at a list of the states with the most reported sightings, or certainly the most documented ones, deserts, or traditionally desert-based states, Bruce, do rank very highly. I know Utah is one of the top 10, the top 12, Colorado, right. New Mexico, even Arizona. And these are states that, for most people, they just would not consider anything or any possibility that there could be such creatures around here. And yet, when I've been speaking to people, especially from Texas, Texas has a long history. But once again, Texas is a state that most people consider to be, you know, it's three big cities and oil wells. And they don't appreciate that there is a lush wetland at the corner of one of the states, which is a phenomenal piece of habitat. So when you move to Utah, is it something that even you were surprised when, with your experience and love of the subject, Bruce, that it ranks so highly in reports?
I had always heard rumors that Utah could be a good source on where this animal might be eventually documented. But when I moved here and continued researching here, I was in the mountains. I didn't go out into the desert. So it did surprise me that there's also a history here of these animals in desert environments, or what we would consider less than optimum or surprising environments for them to be found in. But they've always been here also.
Yeah. And one of the things I found interesting when I've read your work, Bruce, is, and it's a very obvious thing until when somebody points it out and you're like, of course, is this correlation with water coursing, as usual, where it seems that, as with any animal, Bruce, they will usually be wherever there is where there's a large body of water or access to water available freely.
That was actually a little bit of a surprise also, too. Obviously, you know, that's a critical thing for any animal exploiting the desert environment. Mm. I found probably slightly less than half of all of the observations observe that animal at either the water's edge of a predictable water source or within 1 mile of it. Mm. But, and then it continued out as what would be expected the further out you went, but there were still sightings within 10 to 20 miles away from known water. Mm. and even in excess of that. And I was a little surprised at the additional water sources that are available. Some of those are man-made, but in Utah here, there's springs where you wouldn't expect them. So there are plenty of other water sources, but I think sometimes we don't often regard other sources of water.
Yeah.
And that could be provided by diet. If, depending on what this animal eats, it can metabolize water by the oxidation of the fats and the proteins and the carbohydrates it consumes. Mm. Carbohydrates aren't as common in a desert environment, but you can extract slightly less than half a gram of water from a gram of protein that you consume, or a full gram of water from a gram of fat that's consumed. So the animal's diet can also maybe allow it to range further from known water sources also.
Mm. I mean, it's one of those challenges, I suppose, when we're dealing with the investigation of such creatures, Bruce, that we have to look at perhaps some parallels in the natural world that we are aware of, that animals will often turn up in the most surprising of places and find a way to adapt their diet and their behaviour. I suppose one of the biggest challenges you've got when you're researching hominid cases in such environments is both you've got a difficulty, I would imagine, with the terrain and also the environment, because it can be blisteringly hot during the day, but also I would imagine it can be extremely cold in the evening. So it's probably not the best environment to do any kind of long-term investigation.
It can definitely be challenging, but I certainly wouldn't call it prohibitive. Mm-hmm. But depending on the animal's behavior, that makes it more challenging to try and document and understand what they're doing under these circumstances also.
Is it an aspect that you've had to look at some of the more well-known states in regards to the reported behaviors, Bruce, and see how it kind of reflects in these environments such as Utah and Colorado, that does the animal's behavior change in regards to when the sightings are more likely or where they're seen? Are they seen as often? Many witnesses will report driving along roads late at night in quiet areas where a creature will just cross a road, unsuspecting that that it is about to be seen by someone due to the fact that they're travelling in a car. Is there a similar kind of body of evidence in regards to the witnesses that you come across, or is it a very broad spectrum in regards to these encounters?
I actually thought that there would be when I first began the study.
Mm.
I thought that potentially there might be differences in their appearance and morphology, that there might be differences in their behavior as reflected, you know, in this environment. But what I actually found was that was generally not the case if we consider the existing literature to be accurate. So they're generally cited when some of the more traditional areas would report similar to that. Their appearance and size is similar. Their behaviors are similar. So I was a little surprised there that I wasn't able to observe as many differences as I thought there might be.
Yeah. And I suppose that is surprising, because when we look at other animals in the natural kingdom, Bruce, there are some rather notable changes in their coloration or their behavior. So that I find quite surprising as well, that you don't get such a dramatic change. That I suppose, once again, that's being pushed by the knowledge that we have in existing nature to kind of expect that kind of adaptation that doesn't seem to occur.
I would think you're probably right. Generally speaking, animals that live in desert habitats tend to be smaller.
Mm.
Their groups tend to be smaller. And though we don't have extensive information on that in any type of environment, it doesn't appear to be the case on what we do have in those more expected environments and desert environments.
Yeah. It's fascinating for me that doesn't seem to be going on here, because you would expect that. And therefore, I suppose that kind of changes your investigations, because you then have to kind of begin to question then, well, how can such a creature exist in these environments? Because, as you say, most animals that live in such environments are usually smaller and tend to travel lighter, whereas clearly if we're talking about a population that's being able to exist, you've got to have access to food, water and cover. And I suppose, once again, it's one of those aspects that people will just imagine that there's just nothing but desert around. But obviously there are very different environments encountered in these states, that you do get mountain ranges with forestation.
Oh, exactly. I basically examined about 7 to 8 different type of zones, mm-hmm. in the desert, and they were observed in all of them.
Huh.
There were some that they were predominant in, but the desert is pretty rich and vibrant, and it's got pretty expansive micro and micro environments, so, and they can vary just between small distances between them. So it's a way more dynamic environment than maybe people would think, or if they don't have the experience of being out in it, they might not realize that.
Yeah. Have you noticed any kind of correlation with the weather, Bruce, in regards to, obviously, certain areas are prone to having large rainstorms and thunderstorms at certain types of the year? Is there a kind of spike in encounters, or does it seem to be something that happens throughout the year? There doesn't seem to be any particularly favoured point of the year that these creatures are sighted more.
Preliminarily, there really were no differences in weather,
mm-hmm.
or moon phases. I guess if there was a slight spike, it would be during the summer months.
Mm-hmm.
But that brings in a little bit of a problem with observational effort. Human beings tend to be more active and traveling that time, during that time, so more likely to observe a Sasquatch if it's moving around at that time. So they're seen in all seasons, but summer probably 3/4 of the time, followed by autumn, winter, and then spring.
Yeah, but as you say, that would make common sense, because people are more likely to be about. So if you want to play devil's advocate on that kind of situation, Bruce, as you say, there's more sightings because there's more people about. That's not to say that they're any less frequent in December as they are in June.
That's true. And Utah is still pretty active in the winter. It's got a population that love the outdoors and spend a great deal of time in the outdoors during all seasons. So that would be interesting to do another study and see if we could see what type of observational influence it might impact these findings. Yeah. It's certainly challenging right now with the test subject, but it would certainly be worthy of additional study.
Yeah, absolutely. Is it something that, as we've often heard, Bruce, with other investigators and researchers over the years, especially for yourself, as someone that's got a long career in law enforcement, often we are made aware that it's kind of an open secret that strange things are going on, Bruce, but nobody really wants to talk about it in public or in the media. Obviously, as your career took you into law enforcement, was that the kind of thing where you would get these reports or people would mention these reports that weren't for public consumption? It was just generally kind of chit-chat in the station.
There was definitely that. We would talk about it amongst ourselves. I've had people ask me not to divulge their identities, but they've had the animals in their rifle sights. And then another gentleman, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Patagonia clothing line, outdoor clothing line.
Yes, absolutely.
I, in the mid-90s, I actually lived in the neighborhood with one of the founders, Tom Frost. I didn't really know who he was at the time, and we saw each other at a gathering. I knew who he was informally, and I guess he must have heard about my interest, and he asked to speak to me, and I didn't really know who he was. He was very nice and very humble. I wasn't aware of his significant mountaineering background, and he asked me about it, and I confirmed I did have an interest in it, and he told me, he said, I do a little bit of mountain climbing. He really minimized his background. He said, I was actually in Nepal in the Himalayas, and I had a Yeti approach me in my camp. So you get things like that, and military members that see them on bases that will definitely reach out, and some of them are unexpected. I have a friend who's a retired Green Beret soldier, and he told me of a road crossing in front of him in a snowstorm in Montana. So there are interesting disclosures, and it's becoming a little bit more publicly acceptable, I guess, to discuss it. So the sightings tend to come in a little bit more frequently now.
Would you suspect that because of your background, Bruce, because obviously you are a marine biologist, you're also somebody with law enforcement experience, that you're a credible person for someone to come forward and talk to because they appreciate that you have this knowledge and this interest in this subject, but also because of your professional and academic history, you're someone that will listen to them, if that makes sense?
It does, and I would hope so. I try to be objective in my conversations and try to be a good listener and make mental notes of the data.
Yeah. Would you say that being or having this law enforcement experience, when you're interviewing witnesses and doing investigations, how much of that professional experience and the capacity of the knowledge you've garnered over the years in your career, Bruce, you bring to these investigations when you're dealing with witnesses or going out there looking for evidence?
Probably a good deal of it. Maybe even the majority of it. Most police officers are aware that there are different qualities of witnesses, even if they don't understand why that is. And they're not lying. They're not being deceptive. So sometimes you'll hear people evaluate a witness and make the determination, they seem credible to me, therefore I believe this story or this account. But there's much more involved in evaluating a witness, and there's different ways you can evaluate them. Certainly, deception is part of it, or misidentification, but there's also the influences of our brain and our perception and our memories, especially under stress or when adrenaline is present from a sympathetic nervous system reaction. And so I try and evaluate them for that too. It doesn't necessarily mean that they didn't see what they're reporting, but perhaps aspects of the report or characteristics or behaviors that they're seeing, they didn't really see, or they misinterpreted it, or they're misremembering it. There's all types of false memory and confabulations and inattentional blindness that play into this. Obviously, expectation and confirmation bias can influence reports. So they're pretty significant. And in some of the studies I'm involved in right now, I'm trying to make allowance for that, because I think potentially some of these misperceptions and false memories are influencing the data set negatively. And perhaps that's why we're getting these alternative theories, whether or not it's, you know, dealing with quantum physics or other spiritual aspects of it. I think potentially these might have these particular witness memory distortions or perception distortions may have influenced everything negatively, and now we're proposing non-biological theories and ideas for the existence of this animal and its behavior.
Yeah, I think often a danger is with any kind of situation, especially if it's one that causes an emotive response, Bruce. Sometimes your mind or your brain will fill in the gaps and give you a narrative that, as you refer to there, people end up misremembering the actual incident, because a brain is a powerful thing, and often when someone has a shocking experience in whatever walk of life, the brain will sometimes try and protect the witness from what they've actually seen.
Exactly. And sometimes with inattentional blindness, basically your brain is attending or paying attention to whatever it believes is the most important thing at that moment. Mm. And so you don't realize what you've missed. But oftentimes when you speak to somebody after that, they will fill in details and characteristics and behaviors that they never saw. Mm. They're not being deceptive, but they're trying to fill in the blanks. And so there's ways that you can interview and go through that to try and identify those memories, try and see if you can extract a little more quality and accurate information from them, and also exclude those things that were likely the result of misperception.
What are the chances in regards to the areas that you investigate, Bruce, that people could, as is often put forward in other such areas around the US and Canada, there is misidentification that these people are just seeing normal creatures acting strangely?
I would say there's probably a significant percentage of them. I hear stories about interactions between animals and these hominoids. And though I suppose it's a possibility, it's more probable than not that they never existed. And so perhaps some type of confirmation or expectation bias influenced that perception and that memory. Mm. I would think it's probably a fairly common problem.
Well, it just proves that regardless of the terrain, it can still happen wherever you are then.
Exactly. And you can train yourself to be a little bit better observer. And it just takes repetitions and practice, but it's certainly something that you could do. But oftentimes we don't know, especially in the case of significant sympathetic nervous system reactions, exactly how we'll respond. Mm. It can be even in trained individuals, like police officers and other public safety officers, their behavior can change dramatically with that type of activation. Mm. And it provides misunderstandings, misperceptions. It influences the memory. So the memory actually doesn't correspond accurately with the reality of an event or an observation. So it's just one of the human factors that influences us all.
When you've been delving into this research, I would imagine the more you've worked in these areas and the more times you've spoken to people, Bruce, I would imagine there are occasions where you'll speak with witnesses or you'll get a report of an encounter that's very surprising. Is there any cases that you've come across recently that have surprised you, or have you found extremely compelling that it can't be misidentification or misremembering, that the person's clearly, as you refer to, someone was looking down the scope of their rifle, they'd clearly got something in their sights that it would be hard pressed to misremember something like that?
One of my favorite ones, it's in kind of right on the north end of my study area here. And it was of a young boy who was looking out his kitchen window in his house. The back of the house where the kitchen window kind of faced the mountain range that they're suspected to be living in. And he reported that he saw a small chimpanzee running along the side of the mountain, and it went into a ravine. He was very adamant. He wouldn't call it anything but a chimpanzee. Mm-hmm. But he called his mother at the time, and his mother came and witnessed it also. So that's one I've always found interesting in the study area. If we allow that he is somewhat accurate in his size, it perhaps suggests that the study area also includes younger classes of these animals too, which suggests possibly a family arrangement as opposed to a solitary animal.
Yeah. Well, without wishing to sound blasé, there has to be some kind of population there, because obviously they have to come from somewhere. So clearly, are there reports of multiple sightings of creatures, or is it often the case where they'll get a fleeting glimpse of what we would consider a juvenile, or are there reports of family units in such areas?
I have heard of reports of probably 4 to 5 animals at a time. Hmm. I would like to substantiate them better before I include them into a data set.
Yeah.
But primarily, they're single animals that are observed at any one time. And at least in my particular study area, and in the Southwest United States. Although in the late 1800s, there are reports of groups of these animals frequenting areas there in the desert regions of Southern California. And they were reported as, groups with what appeared to be a dominant male or a dominant animal in the group. So there are definitely reports of them, just primarily they appear to be mostly single animals in any one particular sighting.
And I suppose what I've found interesting when I've spoken to other researchers and investigators, Bruce, one of the best pieces of advice I received was that it's very easy to kind of put a human perception on an encounter or the perceived behavior of such a creature, that as we see, you see one and people will say, oh, well, this one might be scouting it out, or it's going out for food. I suppose with your background, you're able to take a step back from that kind of, once again, that kind of personal bias where you're trying to create a scenario by accident, as it were, that you're trying to put a human set of characteristics or behaviors on these encounters.
That's actually pretty common, where we try and ascribe or attribute some type of motive to what we believe and understand. I think oftentimes it would be helpful to maybe compare the behavior of what we're seeing to the selection process. How does that support that? Examine the environment a little more closely. What is it about the environment that supports or influences that behavior? And if we're unable to see those things, certainly it may not rule out our initial observation, but it certainly may influence a more accurate understanding or interpretation possibly of what we've just seen.
And do you still get the various behaviors reported, Bruce, in regards to, obviously, most of us have heard recordings of alleged howls or wood knocks or rock throwing? Is that something that still seems to occur in these states? Or is it once again one of those things where perhaps it's it's not as well reported, or is it more often than not it's people just seeing these creatures rather than actually, as they would call it, a Class B sighting, when you hear something rather than see something?
Certainly, like other ones, the Class B tend to be more common.
Mm-hmm.
Close to a quarter of the observations involved vocalizations, but roadway crossings, the animal watching or surveilling the witnesses, that's still ranked there. They were observed eating and drinking, still demonstrating what was perceived as aggression or territoriality. There were still reported wood knocks and vegetation and tree destruction. They still were hiding, they still were running, and a very small percentage reported nests. So it's fairly comparable to what we would expect or what is attributed to these animals in what we consider more optimum environments. So I think it's fairly comparable.
Ah. So in regards to those kinds of reports, Bruce, is there a specific area where the nests are more prevalent? Is it where a specific type of tree grows, or are they spread across your research area, or does it tend to focus on one particular part of the state or states that you look at in regards to the nests?
I'm trying to look into that a little bit more. I've been participating with a group called Project ZooBook.
Yes.
And it's headed by Amy Boo. She's the facilitator, and in there are probably half of the people are doctoral level anthropologists and primatologists and zookeepers of primates. So I've actually been exploring how those nests would look, how they would be fashioned, where I could expect them in an environment like a desert. So we're still trying to figure that one out a little bit. They only comprised 1% of the behaviors that were involved or implied. So there's statistically, it's pretty minimal to make any assumptions or projections on that. But I hope to.
Yeah. Well, I think it's one of those aspects, and I find that very interesting because it's one of those facets of this whole phenomenon that I think if you just take it on face value, Bruce, you kind of miss what's going on, if that makes sense. Because for me, I always used to think about, oh, well, they're just nests. Whereas now I'm thinking, well, what kind of vegetation are they built out of? What type of time of year are they found? Do they tend to be in one particular area rather than everywhere? So I think when you're working in that kind of environment with people that have studied primates in the wild, they have a whole range of knowledge that perhaps we've been missing in cryptozoology. And I think that's one of the really important aspects of projects such as Project ZooBook.
It's been a tremendous resource for me. I was invited, and that in the mid-90s, I began to look at known and extant primates as possible analogs to study relicominoid behavior. And I was at the time looking at chimpanzees and their predatory behavior and group behavior, and wanted to see if there were any similarities, or if we could round out the behaviors of relicominoids using these as patterns. And so Project ZooBook has been invaluable, almost as a form of peer review and additional information that is actually fairly difficult to get under most circumstances.
Were you surprised to find these educated people as interested in the subject? Because often, as I'm sure you're aware, Bruce, many people will say, oh, anybody with an educated background simply isn't interested in this subject, which I think we both know is simply not true. They just can't come forwards.
I was maybe a little surprised, but then when you hear their backgrounds and their education and thoughts, and some of them are admittedly what they would term on the fence, but they're very easy to work with. They're very obviously very intelligent, but they're also very humble and willing to help and provide their thoughts too. So my guess would be there's probably more of them out there than we know. It's
yes.
Just not to their advantage to come forward at this particular time.
Yeah. All power to them. I think anybody that's brave, regardless of the fact that they're still retaining their anonymity in regards to this, Bruce. I think it shows that there is a real interest in this subject, because even if you want to look at it on a cultural basis, if none of this is true and we're all wasting our time, then the other aspect is, what on earth are people seeing? And I think anybody with a background in biology or primatology, it's a very tantalizing subject, whichever way you come at it, whether if you want to be on the fence or very skeptical or whatever, there's still something happening, whichever way you want to come at the subject, I think.
It is fascinating, isn't it? And there was, you know, there has been participation by people who were mostly just interested in the culture that develops from people with this interest. So I think you can look at it at all levels, but I think a lot of, and I wouldn't want to speak for them, but I think a lot of the scientists are beginning to understand there is data and information that is highly suggestive that these animals do exist. And it would be difficult to discount without some additional research than to discount it out of hand.
All power to them. I think anybody that's pushing the boundaries, regardless of what's acceptable science or not, Bruce, should be applauded.
It's been very refreshing. I appreciate my interaction with them for sure.
I think one of the most interesting aspects of your work, Bruce, is that you seem to have a foot in two camps in cryptozoology, which is quite unusual. Often people will tend to specialise on one set of weird creatures. And yet, you seem to be as passionate about another cryptid that I'm also deeply fascinated in, which is the phenomena of sea and lake creatures. Did you always have an interest in the whole subject of cryptozoology, or were you one of those people that was corrupted at an early age through the Beast of Boggy Creek and the Patterson-Gimlin film and then discovered sea creatures, or were they two creatures that went hand in fin, I suggest?
Well, I was corrupted by those also, yes. But actually my interest began even before that, when I would read some of the early works, you know, Ivan Sanderson and Bernard Heuvelmans, anything that was available in the library. So I had a pretty early interest in the subject and have remained interested in it since that time.
Yeah, I've often been fascinated because for me, I think even in general, Bruce, in the world of animals and creatures in general, I think that the fact that we know so little about the world's oceans is such a ripe subject for discovery that I find it incredible to consider that we haven't found something strange lurking under the waves, because it's, for me, it makes more sense than anything else out there in the whole realm of cryptozoology, Bruce. Because as someone who's, as we've mentioned, a marine biologist and as someone that worked in that field, I believe in the import and export business in your early career, I would imagine you came across creatures that even you were surprised to stumble across that are in the natural world. So how do you view that whole range of cryptozoology in that field?
Obviously, my opinion is probably similar to most people, that the oceans are so expansive, and we find new species yearly, some of them quite large, to even small ones. So obviously it's an environment where the ocean would continue to yield new species that we didn't know about. There are scientists that do statistical studies on how many species we could expect and what groups and families they might be represented by. So I think that's pretty common. But I wanted to look at it historically too, and then try and maybe sort out the database a little bit. That's a primary, at least in my opinion, in cryptozoology in general, whether we're speaking of Sasquatches or sea monsters, is that the data is everywhere. And we regurgitate the same stories over and over. Some of them have utility for the data set and some less so. And so I began my study trying to gather and format what data was available, these observations, and then to sort it for credibility or usefulness. I didn't want to include all of them. Like I don't want to include all Sasquatch sightings. It's not helpful to include incorrect data into the data set, it will skew our research and our plans. And the same was true with sea serpents. So it's been an interesting study, and it's been helpful to develop that methodology.
I mean, I was really impressed with the fact that you seem to look at over a couple of thousand alleged sea creature encounters, Bruce, which is a phenomenal amount. And I suppose it's one of those things that, as with anything, some creatures fall in and out of fashion. Sea monsters are a prime example that they don't tend to be overly reported, it would seem, to the outsider these days, Bruce. But I think, once again, once you dig into it, people are still seeing very strange things at sea or in lakes as well. So for you, when you decided to kind of sift it down to a more manageable amount, how on earth did you attack that? Because I suppose if you look at, as we were talking about, Sasquatch and large creature reports from the 19th century, the 19th century seemed to be awash, pardon the pun, with reports of sea captains and passengers on boats all around the world encountering strange large creatures at sea.
It was dawning. It took 6 to 7 years just to read and gather all of the data, even before I began to analyze it. It became pretty apparent that I needed a sorting process, and so I developed a methodology of quality control. And so I would award observations points based on what was available from that observation. And I've begun to use that with Bigfoot sightings also. But generally, a sighting could receive a maximum of 11 points. And I found that it was statistically sensitive to about 5 points. So that was the minimum any observation could receive to be included into the data set. And so points were awarded based on the experience of the observer, if there was a competent investigator, meaning they had a background in a life science or something like that, how detailed the account was and the physical description that was provided. Oftentimes we confuse detailed accounts with accuracy and honesty, and that's not necessarily the case, or that the observer had a reputation for credibility, or their reputation would suffer significantly with a fraud or exaggeration. If there were multiple witnesses, that provided another point. I understood during my undergraduate work, I was a volunteer on a great white shark predatory attack study. And we would film and document the sharks on the surface after they would kill a seal or sea lion and consume them. So I kind of understood by experience the maximum distance you could maybe expect to view an animal on the surface very briefly and be able to describe it and describe its behavior. So if the distance was observed under that, it was provided a point. If the length of the observation was in excess of 60 seconds, if there were biogenic structures associated with the sighting, meaning did the animal change the landscape? Did it damage objects? And the animal would have to be witnessed doing that, so you could attribute that damage to the animal's behavior. If there was physical evidence, like a carcass or tissue samples, that was actually awarded 2 points. And then if there was a photograph or film or a verifiable sonar return, that would provide another point.
Yeah.
And so I understood that I would probably exclude some legitimate observations and quite possibly include some that were misidentifications or something else, but I needed to stay with the process. And so once I sorted according to that score out of the 1,200 or so observations, I only had 358 remaining that I could analyze, slightly less than 30%. But I think that gave me a little better data set to work with and develop these proposed natural histories.
I mean, that's still a hell of a number, though.
Oh, yeah. It kept me busy there, too.
I mean, I've often been fascinated by encounters with creatures at sea or in lakes, Bruce, that don't fit the normal templates of what we expect a sea serpent or a giant snake to look like. And obviously one of your aspects of your classification is reports of creatures that we could class as crocodilian. Were you surprised when these reports would come out? Because obviously crocodiles can grow to phenomenal length. You only have to look at some of the salties in Australia and the alleged reports of some of the sizes in the Far East and Africa in regards to Nile crocodiles as well. Gustav is a prime example of an infamous crocodilian. So were you surprised that people were reporting these creatures? Because they don't fit the normal template of, if you say sea monster to somebody, they're probably not going to think it's crocodilian.
They did occur, but they didn't occur with much frequency. I think it was slightly under 2% of all of my reports were what I labeled as a saurian animal, a marine saurian, which would look like a crocodilian. Mm-hmm. I suppose the main difference would be the maximum length they were reported, or out of the range of the known species that we have. Yeah. They were said to approach, 20 meters in length, which is quite large, but their range is also interesting, too, in that they're primarily reported in the North Atlantic or the Mediterranean, which, outside of some of the smaller crocodiles in the Mediterranean, or excuse me, that's the Caribbean, there are no crocodilians in those areas. So they're a little bit out of place if indeed those are accurate.
Yeah. I mean, the Mediterranean, as areas go, is quite a temperate sea anyway. And obviously, there are areas where you could imagine a Nile crocodile could end up somewhere by mistake. But that's seeing something completely out of where you would expect it, isn't it?
It is. And I think primarily that's why it ended up being, even to a small degree, included into the data set, is the particular ranges they were observed in.
Mm. I think one of the other interesting aspects is that you've also kind of used this classification in regard to lake monsters, which often people try to keep them completely separate, Bruce, which I find odd, because there are enough bodies of water in the world that have a connection to the sea. And as a marine biologist, I'm sure you're aware, there are several species of sea creature that can adapt and survive, even for short periods of time, in fresh water. So are you surprised that people still want to keep them separate?
I suppose viewing the animals as being only marine animals make it a little easier to accept than some of the smaller bodies of water. And a lot of that is we make some assumptions that maybe could be overcome with some other questions. Certainly small bodies of water or bodies in temperate to subarctic environments with the temperature, they could certainly be limiting factors, but oftentimes we presuppose that these lake monsters are plesiosaur body plans, which I've not found that to be the case, but they're fish eaters. And so we base a lot of our theories and understanding on available fish stocks in these bodies of water.
Mm-hmm.
I've not seen anything that would suggest that they're obligate fish eaters. And also there was enough data to suggest, and it's potentially part of my theory, that the animals may not remain in those bodies of water. And so potentially there doesn't need to be the food stocks in there. They don't necessarily need to remain in the water during winter or cold periods or poor water quality. They can actually move about or move between bodies of water if they needed to.
If we're even looking at it based on the information we have on existing marine species, Bruce, there are numerous examples of creatures that will travel hundreds and thousands of miles for different reasons, aren't there?
Oh, absolutely. And they range from salmonids in rivers to eels and lampreys to bull sharks. There's certainly precedent, both in extant animals and also in the fossil record, supports that some of these ancient marine reptiles frequented subarctic temperatures, both in marine and in freshwater. Mm. So there's precedent both in the fossil record and today of this particular behavior. So it wouldn't be out of the ordinary.
I think one of the most incredible witness cases that I've heard you discuss before, Bruce, and I've only briefly heard much about it. So if it's all right with you, I'd like to touch on, before I let you go, because I'll never forgive myself if I don't talk about this case with you. And this is the Clark Brothers encounter, which was it recorded in San Francisco Bay, I believe?
Yes, in the late 80s is when they began to record these animals.
Yeah, so for anybody, I mean, I find it fascinating that this case isn't more well known, if that makes sense, because I think when I've heard you talk about it, it sounds incredibly compelling what these gents recorded. So for anybody who's not aware of it, would you mind giving us a brief synopsis of what was alleged to have occurred?
Sure. Beginning, I believe, in the late 80s, I actually made contact with them in the early and mid-90s. These two brothers, Bill and Bob Clark, who lived in the San Francisco Bay Area, observed on a number of occasions these long serpentine animals. And on occasion, they would also videotape them. It was at distance, so there was camera shake and things like that. But I used some of the equipment I had. I reached out to them and asked them if I could have permission to view their video and stabilize it and alter it. And they were very gracious. There were no expectations on their part. So I was able to stabilize it and identify at least five different animals at a lot greater lengths than I would have expected. And they would move about in San Francisco Bay. Possibly this was a lekking area for males. In part of the videos, besides them moving and seeming to orient towards and away from each other and circle back, one animal elevated approximately 20 feet above the surface of the water vertically before it came back down. They've sent me a couple other videos. They're no longer active. When I asked them, they said they're just getting a little bit older and it's harder for them to get out there. But they were very open and would describe any parts of their observations if you would ask them. I don't believe they were aware of it at the time, but that area has a lot of historical observations of similar animals, generally around the shoreline. And I didn't tell them either, but I was aware of observations 100 miles upstream in the Sacramento River of these animals. So very fascinating. I would imagine they would still be there if someone had the equipment and be able to film them, or possibly, and I don't know if they would surface, if occasionally boats would come through based on the video that I reviewed, but how visible they would be. But they were very, very active in the videos that the Clark brothers provided me.
Were you surprised that they knew so little about this phenomenon? Because I suppose one of the things that stands the Clark brothers in good stead, Bruce, is their naivety in regards to the subject.
Yes. They certainly educated themselves. They learned about the history of the area. They had other people who had sightings reach out to them, but they also documented everything they did. They didn't try and influence me or my findings. I suggested in a paper that these were what I term a type 3 multiple hump animal, and showed them an artist's rendering of it. They disagreed with me on that, but they were always respectful and easy to work with and always responded to any questions I asked. But they almost became the experts on the animal in Northern California and built those relationships with other people who had seen those animals too.
Is there a larger history of these reports on the western side of the U.S. compared to the eastern side? Because I can think of a couple of notable cases on the eastern side, but from my basic understanding of the subject, and I'm certainly nowhere near as well read or well investigated as yourself, Bruce, the west tends to seem to be more profitable in regards to hunting strange creatures in the sea.
They're certainly reported more recently on the West Coast. Mm-hmm. You're probably aware on the East Coast, for long periods of time, they were reported all along the Eastern Seaboard, and Maine still has their there's serpent in Casco Bay, and there's in Chesapeake Bay, and further down. So there's history there, but it seems like the sightings are more frequently reported from the Pacific Northwest coast of North America. Mm. And there you have the creature that's commonly termed as Kiborosaurus. You have them going down Bobo and Monterey Bay, California, and, you know, all places in between. They're known in the Columbia River. Claude, I believe, is what it's nicknamed, that comes off the Pacific Ocean up there. So they're neat. They're also observed in a lot of the river drainages, and some people have proposed that they're following the salmon runs in from the ocean.
Yeah, interesting. Very interesting. I find that quite fascinating that they seem to be more recently fashionable on that side. Well, not fashionable. I think more recently reported on that side. You would suspect that because both coasts have extremely popular tourist destinations, which I suppose is something that may play into why they may be reported more commonly on the west, do you suspect?
Potentially. It's probably the environments may differ somewhat. On the Pacific coast, I've noticed when they're seen inland, they're generally in rivers.
Yeah.
And there are quite a few islands and things like that. There have been young that have observed. So their behavior might be a little different there, where oftentimes on the eastern seaboard, they would be seen in very shallow water and marshes frequenting there. So it might just be observational effort there also, that they're more easily observed on the west coast than they would be now anyway on the east coast. Although they are still periodically seen on occasion on the east coast also.
Yeah. No, it's a fascinating subject because I just, like we said, we touched on at the beginning when we dove into this, I just find the potential for something unknown to be out there probably far greater than any other aspect of cryptozoology, primarily because there's so much ocean.
Well, there is, and we continue to discover new and large animals. Within the last couple of years, two large species of beaked whales have been discovered. In the case of this multiple humped animal, it was photographed in 1937. And so there's been documentation of that. And I ran into a lot of historical sightings which described the very unique characteristics of the animal long before the photo was taken in 1937 and before it was published in 1995. So there is quite a lot of data to support these animals in the ocean.
I suppose one last aspect I'll touch on as well is one of the creatures that seems to be extremely fashionable and has been over the last sort of 10, 20 years, Bruce, and this may cause you to sigh in desperation, is the potential for an extremely large species of shark to still be out there that we've yet to discover. I mean, anybody that's had the fortune to see the footage of Deep Blue, I believe she's called, which is the largest great white ever filmed, as far as I'm aware. You may know more on that specifically, Bruce. But I think, what's your thoughts on that? I'm not necessarily saying the potential of a prehistoric creature still being out there, but the range of a creature to expand even beyond what we've discovered in regards to how large Deep Blue was, because that footage is just jaw-dropping.
It certainly, historically and occasionally, there are still sightings that are reported from the Torres Strait north of Australia. They're not as frequent anymore, or at least I'm not aware of them. I would certainly be interested in hearing some explanations and proposals as far as why Megalodon or something similar still exists, and how the environment and prey species can influence their growth and their range and things like that. Very rarely will you hear anyone ever propose anything like that. So oftentimes I would think some of these observations might be misidentifications of larger beaked whales, which can get considerably larger than what people think, or other whales also. So I haven't really seen any evidence that that these animals are still in existence. Hmm. They would certainly, sometimes you'll hear that, oh, well, they would be a deep water species, potentially. We've found that great white sharks now will go to depths that we didn't suspect of back when I was involved in this study.
Yeah.
So I guess potentially there, but it becomes a little more difficult potentially to reside down there for any length of time and be able to find the necessary food.
Yeah.
That would just be some of my preliminary thoughts there, but I would certainly be open to looking at anybody else's data and evaluating it.
It's certainly a tantalizing subject, but like you say, I think often it seems to be more hearsay than actual witness accounts, sadly. And I think often things can often take on a life of their own, especially in this day of YouTube and internet forums, Bruce.
I would probably agree.
Well, Bruce, thank you so much for your conversation tonight. It's been thoroughly fascinating to finally get a chance to talk to you about both of these subjects, because I find your work deeply captivating and extremely thought-provoking. Where can everybody keep up to date and get hold of some of your work?
Well, I think you can go to Amazon and you can still get the fourth volume of the Journal of Cryptozoology. That's where my study of lake monsters comes in, where I correlate them and review the sea serpent study. Mm-hmm. You can also, I think it's available still on Amazon. My original serpent study was in a cryptozoology volume called Elementum Bestia. Mm-hmm. But that could be a little difficult. I think the last time I looked, they were selling for $600 each. so it might be a little difficult there. But a good deal of my research is cited and summarized by other people on the internet, so you could probably find that fairly easily. And I suppose the easiest way is to, you can reach out to me through you even, Paul, and get a hold of me on Messenger or something like that. If you have some data that I would be interested or have a question, I'm happy to entertain those.
Yeah, I'll certainly be happy to be a conduit if anybody's got anything they'd like you to have a look at. Bruce, no problems at all.
Thank you.
Well, Bruce, thank you so much, as I said, for your conversation. It's been fascinating and thought-provoking and lovely to finally get a chance to speak to you. So thank you so much for your time today. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. I've enjoyed the conversation.